Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to see you again, particularly those of you whom I haven't seen over the last 6 weeks. And we closed last week in order to clean and reset the Zendo from our 5.5 week Ango up at the Grail. And I really want to express my appreciation to those of you who were here scrubbing the floors and vacuuming the cushions and putting things away. And it's a lot of energy and loving work, and I appreciate it very much. I, for one, am very happy to be back here in my home here in the city. We had a very intimate and strong summer retreat. And if you are interested in it, someone who's not here today because he's at Sing Sing, he goes to Sing Sing every Sunday, Jiryu made an absolutely stunning slideshow of some of the activities at the Grail. And I sent it to one of my Dharma sisters, Gyoko Roshi in Los Angeles. I was so proud of the representation of the Ango, and she wrote back, she said, in everyone's face you can just see the quality of samadhi, the quality of rest that is possible when you take a long time to practice together in a sustained way. And I miss those of you who, for whatever reason, weren't able to come. And to tell you the truth, I really missed my city. This morning, as we began right after service, we realized that we did not have a charger for the iPod, and it was not charged. And so I went home. I live, it takes me 10 minutes to get up to my apartment here. So I went home in my robes and got my charger from home and came back. And what I love about New York City is, like, no one looked at me. And even the people that know me, the doorman and everybody, it's like nothing special. This person swooping along in her robe. That's what I love about this city. It's so, there's so much diversity. There's so much going on. You just don't stop and say, oh, that's weird. It's just part of the phenomenal diversity of this city that I love so much. And I love riding in the subway, and I just love living here. And it reminds me, this summer I went, I was ill for a little while. I got some sort of fever or something, and so I wasn't able to do my super hiking. And I would go to this field, and in this field were like butterflies and dragonflies and wasps and bees and all kinds of insects just buzzing, and all of them making different sounds and just kind of moving around. And that's what my home here feels like to me. There's an incredible diversity. And also I realize that there's a lot here in this city that I don't see. There are a lot of things I don't want to see, and therefore I don't look at. And I suspect the same is true for you. There are published studies about this. I think that people regularly simply do not even let into their consciousness very striking phenomena that are going on all the time in their presence. The most popular one of those studies you may recall is the one where someone's giving a lecture and someone dressed in a monkey suit walks across the stage and no one sees him, right? Because it's not something that we expect to see. So I have to ask myself, what is it that walks past me in this city? What is it that's hidden that I don't see? What is it I turn away from and try not to see, try to ignore? This is on my mind right now because of our upcoming street retreat in October, where some of us will go out and live on the street here in this neighborhood for 4 or 5 days. And there's kind of like some concern that, you know, that it's dangerous or something. But actually, we go in a group, and even when we're when we go out to beg, we usually go in couples. So we've never had any kind of safety problems in that sense. But my mind is on that. What is it? Why is that retreat something I feel like I need to do again? I've done it several times. But somehow, again, I notice myself walling off my perception so that there are some aspects of suffering that I just don't want to let in. So that's a sign to me that I need to go back on the street. Because what I noticed when I was on previous retreats is that there are so many people, and usually quite well-dressed people, who are able to walk down the street and they never lower their eyes. They will not look at you when you're sitting there, you know, with a dirty cup in your hand asking for some money. And I remember one year I was sitting like across the street from where I used to teach, where I was teaching at the time at NYU. I sat 720 Broadway, right across the street, and my colleagues, students would walk right by me. They don't look. And I don't want to say we don't look. I want to own my own tendency to pull away from that. I just read this weekend a brilliant essay by Adam Phillips, the psychoanalyst, and Barbara Taylor, the British historian. They published a book called On Kindness. It's the new form of books, you know, they're only 110 pages, but somehow it costs $20, these great essays, but it's worth reading. I encourage you to read it, and probably you can find it online, too. They offer some responses to this idea of why is it that we pull away and refuse to even notice the suffering that's around us. And the first thing that these two authors agree on is a very Zen response. They say that we are denying our interconnection and thinking that the other is not us, not realizing that the self is composed of all the elements that are around it at any moment. So when we're in the subway car, what is our self? It's everything in that subway car. Right. Or maybe we fear, I know this was true of me for a long time, that I'll behave in a sentimental, mawkish fashion. There's this kind of fear of being overly sentimental, right? Or we're afraid of being weak and vulnerable. Or we have bought the idea that in society there are winners and losers, and we only want to identify with winners. We don't want to fraternize or even notice what we would designate as losers. Of course, being Adam Phillips and Barbara Taylor, their arguments are much more nuanced than what I am presenting. And I recommend that you read this. But the point I wanted to make about it is that in so many ways, moment to moment, we try to avoid the unmediated suffering that is around us. And in particular, we avoid the have-nots. And we disdain and look away from beggars and poverty. I guess I would add to their argument, Adams and Taylor, that I know in my own experience there's a sense of guilt also that I have, a sense that I have a comfortable situation in my life and they don't. And that I don't want to face that reality, my responsibility. So what we do is we close the doors of connection. We stop what David Hume called the movement of the heart. We stop the movement of the heart. And that flows into every aspect of our being. And, of course, this is not new. Most spiritual traditions have a practice, a tradition of begging, and an appreciation of voluntary poverty. I've been also reading Peter Morin. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was the co-founder with Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement, right down the street from here. And actually, those of us on the street retreat will go to the Catholic Worker kitchen and have dinner one night. So Peter Morin was this wild Frenchman who was really quite an anarchist and what he called a commutarian. And he wrote this, he wrote poems for the people that were suffering so much during the Depression. Most of his work with Dorothy Day was when there were bread lines around the streets here and people were truly starving on the streets. The name of this poem is "Why Not Be a Beggar?" People who are in need are not afraid to beg. It's hard to read the way he scans this. People who are in need and are not afraid to beg give to people not in need the occasion to do good for goodness sake. So he's saying people who are in need and not afraid to beg give to people who are not in need the occasion to do good for goodness sake. The Greeks used to say that people in need are the ambassadors of the gods. We read in the Gospel, "As long as you did it to one of the least of my brothers, you did it to me." While modern society calls the beggars bums and panhandlers, they are in fact the ambassadors of God. To be God's ambassador is something to be proud of. To be God's ambassador is something to be proud of. You know, I have often had trouble asking for money, even for our Zendo. Poor Zendo, it's, you know, that's its problem in a nutshell. And what I've come to realize is that I have just not been able to be God's ambassador, to see that role of asking as a way of helping people to open their hearts, helping the people to be sensitive to the movement of their heart and to give. So I love Peter Morin's very simple little verse, "The occasion to do good for goodness sake." But the point that he's making is crucial both in terms of the Greeks and in terms of the Christian and Jewish and Islamic traditions, but also in terms of the Adams-Taylor essay, the psychoanalytic perspective, where to give is pleasurable. To give enlarges us. And those who offer us an opportunity to give are to be thanked. We have all these stories. If you read the old sutras, you'll find over and over again, whenever there's a talk that's given by Shakyamuni Buddha, the beginning of that, after Thus Have I Heard, is the Buddha went for a walk, they went begging, they received food, they sat down, they ate their food, then they put their bowls away, and then the talk is given. And so that's kind of like the intro to all of the sutras, is this bit about the Shakyamuni Buddha going off and begging for their food. And in the Japanese Zen tradition, there's a legend about one of the great Zen masters, Daito Kokushi. He was in the Rinzai line, and he lived about 50 years, maybe not even 50, maybe 35 years after Dogen. So kind of a generation after Dogen. And he is really, out of Daito Kokushi came the heart of the Rinzai lineage that exists today in Japan. Like Dogen, he was at a monastery when he was very young. He was at a Tendai monastery at the age of 9. And then he practiced there until he was 19, and then he went and studied with two different Zen masters. Studied with all that kind of power and strength that you have when you're 19, that wonderful energy. And he received Dharma transmission at the age of 26. But his teacher, Dayo, wrote on his transmission document, "Before making this sanction public, you must continue your spiritual cultivation for another 20 years." So you can't tell anybody, right? And actually, 20 years later, he founded what became Daitokuji, the great temple in Kyoto. And when he received his abbotship, he said, "Though I stored this fragrance in a bag for 20 years, the more it was hidden, the more it was manifest." And that's really an important thing, because very often we have very strong opening experiences when we actually finally sit down and meditate. We might have a very powerful, strong experience, and yet you have to keep that fragrance in a bag. If you go pushing it out everywhere and talking about it all the time, it loses its juice. And you forget, you begin to become attached to the words rather than the experience that you had. And the fragrance doesn't manifest, it doesn't grow. So this tradition of, after an opening experience, after Dharma transmission, to keep it hidden, hiding the light, we say, hide your light for 20 years, is a very powerful tradition, which is why we have so many old Zen teachers, not so many young Zen teachers. Anyway, so what to do? 26 years old, Dharma transmission. He goes, and according to the legend, he decides to go live among the beggars under the Gajo Bridge in Kyoto. So he just lived among the beggars for these 20 years. But from time to time, word would leak out that there was a Zen master living among the beggars, and different kinds of noble people would come and try to find him, and he would hide, and no one could ever find Daito Kokushi. Then there was this young emperor, Hanazono, and he really wanted to get this Zen master to come and give lectures and teach him. So he dressed up as a merchant, as a kind of lowly merchant. You know, he was the emperor, for gosh sakes, of Japan. And he dressed up and went in disguise to the bridge. He had heard this rumor that Daito loved a certain kind of sweet melon. And so he got a bunch of these melons and said that he was a merchant, and he was going to hand out these melons down there under the bridge. And each beggar would come up in a line, and he would hand him one of the melons, and he would just look carefully So he thought, I'll be able to guess which one is Daito Kokushi. And then he saw one come up who had these bright, clear eyes. And he said, take this without using your hands. And like a flash comes back, give it to me without using your hands. Unmasked. I love this story. It shows several qualities dear and appreciated in Zen and in human kindness and wisdom. First, there's Daito's humility and of the emperor's humility, willing to disguise themselves, willing to go and essentially let go of status. And the emperor, in order to find a teacher, was willing to do this. It was quite amazing. And Daito, who actually lived there, enduring the cold and hunger, the discomfort, the rowdiness. I mean, Daito was a great poet, a great calligrapher, you know, a sensitive man. The indignities that one finds. I mean, here on the street, one of the major problems is going to be, where do you go to the bathroom? I mean, amazing this city doesn't have, like, public bathrooms, isn't it? But there, most of all, what's curious is this exchange. Take this without using your hands. Give it to me without using your hands. It's a trope that's used often in koan collections, actually. Why is that a man of great strength who does not lift his legs? It's not with your tongue that you speak. This kind of strange way of expressing, to walk without lifting your legs, to speak without moving your tongue, to take a melon without using your hands. What is that about? To be completely alive to the vastness and interpenetration of all the elements is to not separate anything out. And to be able to respond with such liveliness, with such vigor, such quickness, is what betrayed his identity in a moment. So Daito went on to teach the emperor, who became his great patron and endowed Daitokuji temple. Daito became known as the Yunmen of Japan because he started the capping phrase tradition in Japan. A capping phrase is a little phrase that you add on at the end of a koan study. So you work with a teacher with a koan, and at the very end, the student is asked to take a capping phrase, a simple phrase, maybe even one word or two words or 10 words, that sums up the whole point of the koan. And it was Daito Kokushi who started that tradition in Japan. I'm going to read you a couple of his poems. This one's called Rain. No umbrella, getting soaked. I'll just use the rain as my raincoat. Huh? Just use the rain as my raincoat. To take what we think is separate, rain, and put it on. Oh, it's not separate from me, it's my raincoat. Isn't that marvelous? Although some people dispute the story I told you, this little poem alone tells me that he did live under that bridge. Maybe he snuck home at night to study the sutras, but he did live there. Here's another one called Recovery. It's over, the Buddha's and ancestors' disease that once gripped my chest. Now I'm just an ordinary man with a clean slate. That's what I would wish for all of us. Just an ordinary person with a clean slate. And this one, called Tattered Sleeve. So many years of begging, this robe's old and torn. Tattered sleeve chases a cloud. Beyond the gate, just grass. So that last line, beyond the gate, just grass, refers to an old koan. I don't have time to talk about it today, but next time I will. I'll use it as our next talk. Essentially, what it's pointing to is there is no separation between the sacred and the profane, none whatsoever. So inside the gate is inside the monastery, and outside the gate is this marvelous city we live in, right? So inside the gate would be here, and outside the gate would be out there. And grass represents diversity, the relative, and all the weeds and confusions and delusions that we are heir to, inside the gate and outside the gate. No difference. So let me read the poem again. So many years of begging, this robe's old and torn. Tattered sleeve chases a cloud. Beyond the gate, just grass. So, Daito, which means great lamp, great light, became a kind of special mentor through the ages to some of the great teachers that followed, one of whom was E.Q. We all love E.Q., the sexy poet, priest. He wrote this about Daito. After reading exploits of Daito Kokushi, holding aloft the great lamp would illuminate heaven. Oh, imperial carriages jostled before the Dharma hall, but no one recorded his life of wind and water for 20 years under the Gaju Bridge. And then Hakuin painted many portraits of Daito. And one of them shows him very barefoot and all tattered with this bamboo hat on. And Hakuin wrote on that scroll, wearing a straw mat among the beggars, through his greed for sweet melons, he's been taken alive. If you give me the fruit without using your hands, I'll enter your presence without using my feet. So I think Daito Kokushi is a wonderful example for me of that willingness to enter into what at first glance I just want to pull away from, the suffering that's around. We have a methadone clinic right downstairs, and they seem to, they must get the methadone at about 6:30 in the morning, because when I come by at about 7, they're all kind of hanging out there, talking and nodding, and I don't want to see them, and I don't want to feel the pain that I feel. I've had so many encounters with people whose lives have been so destroyed by drugs. And yet, if I don't look, I rob myself. And I rob them, because they know. Even though they may appear to be falling asleep, they know whether you're looking or not. So I'm hoping that we'll talk about this and think about this in the next few months a great deal. What is it that we don't look at? How is it that we harden our hearts? And what would happen if we just attended to the movement of our hearts? If we attended to that, those feelings that are arising, perhaps we could find a way to be of use and to serve in our community. Right here, every day, it's all around us. We just have to lift our eyes or lower our eyes and take a look.